Today, the calm before the storm. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the Property Imperative Weekly to the 23rd of June 2018, our digest of the latest finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. There is something weird going on at the moment. This week, bank stocks rose significantly, with CBA up 1.2% on Friday as the AUSTRAC issue was finally put to bed in court. Westpac was up 1%, NAB was up 1.2%, and ANZ up a massive 2.8% as the bank announced a further stock buyback. The banks comprise more than a quarter of our market, so no surprise that the ASX 200 went higher in the week, though fell back slightly by Friday, reflecting further concerns about the escalating trade wars. Potentially, traders are closing out their positions at the end of the financial year, and this has driven prices higher. But next week, a number of key stocks will go ex-dividend, suggesting that this may have seen the top. The lower Aussie dollar may also be helping and expect it to continue to fall, as it makes Australian stocks cheaper on an international basis, and yields are still pretty good, representing better value to investors than many emerging markets, which are entering a difficult phase. But scratch below the surface and things look less certain. For example, APRA's March 2018 property exposure data showed a significant fall in investment lending and a massive fall in interest-only loans at 16%, dropping the stock of loans by $93 billion. Plus, more loans are being written outside normal serviceability criteria as lending standards tighten. We discuss this in more detail in our post, The State of Mortgage Lending, in three slides. Remember that our analysis shows that around $120 billion of interest-only loans will require refinancing for each of the next 4 or 5 years, and many, around 20%, won't pass muster, meaning that borrowers will have to switch to more expensive loans or sell. ABC 730 did a segment on interest-only loans this week.
House prices in Australia are dropping in most capital cities, with data released today showing Sydney and Melbourne posting their weakest results in 6 years. There are various pressures on the market, but one of the factors that could see prices fall still further is interest-only lending. During the next 3 years, billions of dollars worth of interest-only loans will roll over to principal plus interest, and that could force many Australians into serious financial difficulty.
As UBS put it, the data signals the end of the beginning of the housing market correction, and the risks of a credit crunch are rising. Mortgage underwriting standards continue to tighten as lenders finally comply with the existing legislation and guidelines. In fact, the Royal Commission will not necessarily need to recommend tighter rules at all. The question, in our view, is compliance with the existing ones. APRA, please note. UBS also made the point that debt to income has been a focus since APRA directed ADIs to develop internal risk appetite limits on the proportion of new lending at very high DTI levels, greater than 6 times, and policy limits on maximum DTI levels for individual borrowers. This was in April 2018. Prior to this, DTI was not a focus, largely because neither APRA nor the banks had reliable data available. However, that will soon change with the introduction of Comprehensive Credit Reporting, or CCR, the first phase of open banking, expected on July 1, 2018. They conclude that if APRA does decide to impose a hard cap on loans to customers with a DTI of more than 6 times, we should expect a further tightening in credit availability. Morgan Stanley discussed what they call Macroprudential 3.0, saying that this is consistent with international trends restricting customer leverage in a low interest rate environment. They say the adoption of DTI limits provide a further restriction and may become a binding constraint for customers who have very low assumed living expenses or purchased multiple investment properties. The sustainability of Sydney home prices at greater than 9 times median income and Melbourne at greater than 8 times median income becomes problematic when borrowing limits are restricted to 6 times income. A 6 times DTI limit, assuming a 20% deposit, would put the median Sydney house out of range for the median buyer. The ABS home price data confirmed falls in the major centres. We discussed this in our post, Property Prices Are Officially Falling. And you can watch our video on this or listen to our podcast. Our podcasts, by the way, are being well received, judging by the large number of listeners. As the ABS said, Sydney recorded the third consecutive quarter of falling property prices, down 1.2%, and the first annual price fall, down 0.5%, since March quarter 2012, while Melbourne property prices fell 0.6%, the first quarterly price fall since September 2012. We also contributed to a piece on ABC's The Business, discussing the future outlook for prices.
It isn't a consistent story. While Darwin, Perth, Melbourne, Brisbane and Sydney residential property prices fell during the first 3 months of the year, Canberra and Adelaide rose and Hobart continued to surge.
Those cannot continue the trajectory that they're on at the moment whilst the major markets are actually going into reverse and as the credit tightening continues.
The ABS data is 3 months old, but more recent numbers aren't promising. Auction clearance rates have now fallen to their lowest level since 2012, with just 53.8% resulting in a sale. That's about 10% lower than a year ago. Despite property prices falling, property construction continues to boom. But the risk is that when apartments like these are finished, it will add to supply and cause prices to fall even further.
There's another 200,000 units due to come on stream over the next 12 to 18 months into a market that's already falling. And my own view is that's just going to add more fuel to the fire. More recent data from CoreLogic continues to confirm falls, with weekly drops in Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, and rises in Adelaide and Perth. But of course, Sydney's prices on average are still up more than 66% from their previous lows. Melbourne 56%, Brisbane 21%, Adelaide 19%, and Perth 0.9%. This suggests that further falls in the eastern states are likely as credit dries up. And elsewhere, CoreLogic made the point that more property is being listed and it's taking longer to sell, and so it's becoming a buyer's market, saying, overall, as the housing market is slowing, the number of properties for sale is climbing in Sydney and Melbourne, providing for less urgency amongst buyers and more time to negotiate. As stock levels rise, buyers become more empowered and vendors may need to rethink their pricing expectations and marketing strategies. SQM research also released this week showed that rental vacancies decreased over the year in Adelaide, down 0.4%, Perth, down 1%, Brisbane, down 0.6%, and Canberra, down 0.2%, but significantly increased in Sydney, up 0.8%, Darwin, up 0.2%, and Hobart, up 0.2%, whilst Melbourne's vacancy rates were flat. Annual asking rents are rising faster than incomes in Melbourne, Canberra and Hobart, whilst weak or falling asking rents were recorded in Sydney, Adelaide, Brisbane, Perth and Darwin. SQM said, there are considerably more vacancies in Sydney now compared with a year ago, so landlords have lowered their asking rents slightly, which is favouring renters, so more pressure on investors then. Macquarie said that they expect the current modest rate of decline in national dwelling prices to continue for some time, but they suggest a fall of only around 2% over the course of 2018. And over the next couple of years, they expect national prices to have fallen 4-6% from the peak, with Sydney prices forecast to be down around 10% from their peak. Australia has had six previous episodes of declining house prices since 1980, with the peak-to-trough range of 2.5-8%. Nearly all previous corrections occurred following interest rate rises, a drag unlikely to be repeated anytime soon in this cycle. To which I reply, credit tightening is continuing and the BBSW rate is rising, so past performance may not be helpful here. ANZ also opines on home prices. We now expect to see peak-to-trough price declines of around 10% in Sydney and Melbourne, with smaller declines elsewhere. This cycle is being driven by tighter credit rather than high interest rates. Exactly. Sydney and Melbourne are expected to be the primary drivers of this fall, as their high prices and highly leveraged households will be more sensitive to tighter credit conditions and rising interest rates. It's also worth noting here the heroic assumptions in the New South Wales state budget, which was out this week, and included a projection of future stronger auction clearance rates after a small blip. Lower stamp duty flows will lead to a shortfall, as Moody's observed when they said New South Wales is projecting average revenue growth of 2.5% from fiscal 2019 to 2022, reflecting a drop in growth for transfer duties, particularly from housing, where the state forecasts are that residential turnover will drop around 8% in fiscal 2019 and price growth will moderate. Additionally, at 2.5%, average revenue growth is expected to fall below the average expenditure growth of 3.2%. This imbalance would lead to growth in debt over the forecast period, challenging New South Wales' credit profile. So, recovering home prices and interest rate cuts are required to bring this home. As I say, heroic. There was some interesting commentary on the ever-rising benchmark bank bill swap rate, the BBSW. The AFR reported that Nomura rate strategist Andrew Ticehurst observed that multinationals outside the US are holding fewer US dollars, and there is a global dimension to this, starting with the US. And Tamar Hamlin, portfolio manager at fixed income boutique Ardia, said, "There's nothing to suggest that it's sinister just yet. We expect these things to be high as we get to quarter end, as the historical pattern shows. But we suspect it's more about risks concerning the risk profile of the banks, as the spread movements are larger here than other countries. And this will put pressure on bank margins and may force them to lift mortgage prices or further trim rates on deposits." Oh, and commentary this week from the RBA suggests that the official rates are not going anywhere, despite the fact that the latest minutes omitted the oft-repeated clause that the next move will be up. The Fed released their stress testing of major US banks and gave them a clean bill of health. Though in our separate post, Testing Testing, we discussed the limitations of their approach. First, losses from trading and counterparty losses were estimated at only $133 billion, stemming from nine institutions, including $17.3 billion from the Bank America Corporation, $16.3 billion from Citigroup, $13.3 billion from Goldman Sachs, $29.4 billion from JP Morgan, and $11.7 billion from Morgan Stanley. These estimates of losses are calibrated based on historical performance, but given the massive size of the derivatives markets, this is just a best guess. We discussed the size and shape of the derivatives market recently in our post, The $37 Trillion Black Hole. Second, it's hard to estimate the potential impact of contagion and freezing of the markets, as happened in 2007. as each bank is modelled separately. This begs the question as to whether the system-level modelling is robust enough, especially if one major counterparty fell over during the crisis. 2007 showed the problem when trust across the markets falls and margins widen significantly. And third, the assumptions are that things will revert to normal conditions in a few years, suggesting this is a blip-type crisis. Some of the smaller banks may have performed better in the tests than they would in the real world. But the bottom line, according to the Fed, is that the US banks can stand on their own two feet in the mother of all crises. So no excuse for any bail-in then. Well, we'll see. Looking more broadly across the global markets, the trade war continues to threaten, leaving the major US indices nursing a weekly loss. The US and China exchange a fresh volley of trade threats, scaling back investor appetite for riskier assets amid fears of a tit-for-tat trade war between the two largest economies. This is, in my view, now getting quite serious. However, trade war concerns fail to stem demand for tech stocks, as major tech blue chips such as Facebook, Netflix, and Google rallied sharply, helping the Nasdaq close at a record high this week. This despite internet retailers like eBay and Amazon coming under pressure after the US Supreme Court overturned the Quill ruling, allowing states and local governments to start collecting sales taxes from internet retailers. The S&P 500 posted a weekly loss despite closing 0.25% higher on Friday at 2,759. OPEC agreed on Friday to a modest increase in output, sending crude oil prices soaring on expectations that the fresh supply into the market will be curbed as some countries lack the capacity to raise output. OPEC said it wanted countries part of the production cut agreement to increase production, returning to 100% compliance with the agreed quotas by 1 July 2018. Analysts said the agreement would equate to an increase in production of around 600,000 barrels a day, as numerous countries in the accord aren't capable of increasing production. Crude prices were also supported by a mixed US inventory report as domestic crude supplies fell for the second straight week after crude products such as gasoline and distillate increased by more than the analysts had forecast. Crude futures settled 4.64% higher at $68.58 on Friday. The dollar ended the week lower as trade war concerns flared up, stoking demand for safe haven yen, while a rebound in the euro on mostly positive economic data also weighed on sentiment. The euro-US dollar rebounded from an 11-month low seen on Thursday, prompting traders to flee the greenback, despite lingering concerns over Italian political uncertainty and lower for longer interest rates in the eurozone. The dollar's sluggish end to the week comes just days after its rise to fresh 2018 highs, and it was met by a wave of resistance despite expectations that a more hawkish Federal Reserve would provide further room for upside in the greenback. The divergence between US and the rest of the world monetary policy will support longer and greater US dollar strength than we'd anticipated, Barclays said earlier this week in the note to their clients. The dollar was also held back by yen strength, supported by rising trade tensions between the US and China. The dollar fell 0.36% to 94.2 against a basket of major currencies on Friday. Gold prices bounced from fresh 2018 lows this week, but remained under pressure, struggling to take advantage of a weaker dollar and rising safe haven demand as sentiment on the yellow metal waned. Fearing a faster pace of Federal Reserve rate hikes, investors have shunned the yellow metal even as safe haven demand grows on the back of an ongoing trade spat between the US and China. Fresh selling was seen in Bitcoin on Friday as the crypto hit its lowest level since February after Japan's regulatory crackdown on the industry triggered a sell-off. Japan's largest crypto exchange, BitFlyer, suspended the creation of new accounts after Japan's Financial Services Agency ordered several cryptocurrency exchanges to step up their efforts to combat money laundering. That sent shockwaves through the crypto industry amid fears that other crypto exchanges in Japan could also be forced to scale back operations as they seek to beef up their practices. As Japan is the largest market for Bitcoin trading, the threat of a reduction in fresh fund inflows sparked selling across cryptos, wiping more than $20 billion from the crypto market in under 24 hours. The total crypto market cap fell to about $261 billion from about $289 billion the previous day. Bitcoin was down to $6,015, down 10%. And so, to conclude, while many of the major indicators were higher, this could well be the calm before the storm, as below the hood, the data does not lie. Locally, the tighter credit supply will spill over to lower home prices, and as the next round of the Royal Commission starts next week, we think the banks will be back in the spotlight, but not in a good way. If you like what you've heard here today, please like the post and add a comment or a question. If you want to join the growing band of subscribers who receive alerts when we release new posts, do subscribe now. I'm Martin North, the Principal Analyst at Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you again next time.